and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host this evening, and my co-host from Imagine Publicity, Delilah Jones, is with me this evening. And so I say happy summer, everyone. It's finally good weather here in the great state of Connecticut, and it's always a distinct pleasure to be with you and to greet all of my national guests. So we're really looking forward to this evening's show. And before I tell you a little bit about our guest, I just want to make a brief announcement, or maybe a little pitch, if you will. I would, if you enjoy this show, Shattered Lives, and if you enjoy the content that you find on my website at www.donnagore.com, I would invite you, I would ask you, please, please, to go to LinkedIn to either click on a recommendation or write a written recommendation, because those really do impact the number of people who work there. And as you know, I have career goals for the future and hoping to move to the state of South Carolina. So all you South Carolina people, please get out your computer and write me a recommendation. I really appreciate it. Okay? And Delilah, my co-host, my PR manager, my co-pilot, she is so good to show up every Saturday night when she could be sitting in that traffic in Myrtle Beach. But she's here with me again this evening. She helps me so much. I appreciate her so much. Delilah, thank you. Thank you for showing up every Saturday night, and thank you for co-hosting.
You got it. I'm here.
Well, good.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. The summertime is crazy here. We have the 3 months, well, 3 or 4 months of just total traffic and tourists from all over the country and mm-hmm. all over the world come here. So, you know, it's one of the perks of living in a resort area. You stay home.
Unless you forget and go out into traffic and play in the traffic, right?
Right.
Yeah. I know. Well, speaking of that, you know, there are many types of law enforcement, and our guest this evening happens to be from law enforcement, although he wasn't a traffic cop to my knowledge. So, you know, Delilah, it's not often that we've had somebody from law enforcement. I've had maybe one or two. It's really hard to get these people. So I think we're really fortunate in having Ward this evening, right?
Oh, I totally agree. I'm very excited. You know, our listeners are in for a treat.
I think so. So just to give you a little thumbnail sketch, Ward Hamilton is from Connecticut, residing in the northern part of Connecticut, right near the Massachusetts border. And he happens to be an ex-law enforcement person. He did work, I believe, in the Enfield Police Department. And that was back in the day. So I think he will have a good perspective in terms of what it was like when he wore the badge. However, the other side of the coin is that he has he was awarded a heroism award or a good humanitarian award for having saved a Massachusetts state trooper by circumstance, and that's going to be part of our show this evening. But we also want to talk about what is it like to actually be in law enforcement on the job versus what TV and movies portray. So I think that's very important information because a lot of people get their information from media, and you know that that's not accurate. So without further ado, Ward Hamilton, thank you so much for all that you do for people, and thank you so much for being on Shattered Lives this evening. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, good evening, Donna. Good evening, Delilah.
Yes, yes, we certainly are. And I thank you for making time in your Saturday evening. And just so that people don't forget, in case they're a first-time listener or a new listener, these shows not only are available live, but they're also available at any time, anywhere, on the archives within about 24 hours, and we do write a detailed blog of the content. Okay? So, Ward, let's see. You know, being in law enforcement, I wonder if we know what's out there in terms of how they portray law enforcement people on all kinds of shows, whether it's cops or otherwise, Law and Order, whatever. And I wondered if you could start out for us perhaps to describe what the typical routine for a position that you held. Tell us what kind of position you held and what did really the duties entail, and maybe what are the things that people really don't know about that you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis that you and I made reference to on the phone?
Well, to clarify, Donna, I'd like to let you know that I was a police officer in the New Haven area back in the early...
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. That's okay. I live in Enfield. However,
okay.
This was in the New Haven area.
Okay.
And I was in law enforcement in the New Haven area back in the early 90s.
Yep.
And growing up as a product of television, in particular when the show Cops that airs on television Saturday nights at 8 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
Cops, being a product of that show at a young age, 17, 18, 19 years old, to see the puff, the stuff, the high five, and a lot of the camaraderie, unfortunately, it really didn't delve into a lot of the personal side, a lot of the sacrifices that all law enforcement, whether federal, state, local, make on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, when I first started, was, for lack of a better phrase, quite a rude awakening. In particular, my first day at the academy in Meriden, Connecticut, with 39 other recruits, we were instructed initially by a retired police chief who basically told us that the liability factor on the job is just constantly, you're on high alert all the time for what you do or may not do that
mm-hmm.
can come back to, I guess, again, for lack of a better phrase, bite you.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a year. It could be 3 years. It could be 5 years down the road. We were instructed on essentially protecting ourselves initially, but also to make sure that we protected our financial assets. Because, of course, the public that's out there, not all of them, of course, but a majority of them have not a dim view of law enforcement, but not a clear understanding that police officers are human too, and we make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So that being my first day at the academy, I remember physically seeing a lot of other recruits that I went to the academy with slump in their seats as we were being instructed different ways to protect ourselves.
Wow,
not only physically, but but also from a financial standpoint, and also from just the liability standpoint of being very careful of what we do and what we don't do when we were on the job. And again, this was almost 17 years ago.
Right. Well, can you and since you so aptly corrected me, because it's a whole different scenario comparing Enfield, Connecticut, this kind of a sleepy border town, to New Haven, Connecticut. And can you tell us a little bit about the demographic in terms of crime there? I mean, people across the nation, they go, oh yeah, I know that's where Yale's located, and all of that, but really it is a very dangerous city, is it not?
Honestly, Donna, there isn't any part of small town Connecticut, small city, whether it's New Haven, Hartford, Bridgeport, it doesn't
mm-hmm.
matter where it is. It can be small town, my initial hometown of Longmeadow, Massachusetts. anything can happen at any time.
Anywhere. That's true.
Anywhere, exactly. New Haven, Connecticut.
Newtown is a prime example, right? Newtown
exactly.
is a prime example. Yes.
That's an extreme prime example.
Right.
Sleepy Town, Sandy Hook, a small little nook inside of Connecticut. Who would have ever thought? But again, whether it's Sandy Hook or whether it's small town Suffield, Connecticut, another town I grew up in and graduated from high school from.
Mm-hmm.
New Haven obviously has quite an internationally diverse populace,
yes.
especially when you're dealing with Yale. You have State of Connecticut, Southern Connecticut State University, which is just over the border from New Haven.
Right.
So in some instances, you have people that are coming from all over the world who may have been in a small town or village in Europe coming to Yale. And
yeah.
it's an absolute culture shock, and they don't understand it, and they're very vulnerable and susceptible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure it is quite a culture shock. But so I digressed a little bit just to give people a flavor of New Haven. But getting back to when you were at the academy, you know, the personal risks involved, the risks that you take in terms of offenders and being in court, those other venues. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, from the limited experience I had, and you and I had discussed, I was only on the job for a short amount of time. However, I did have some court interaction with defendants, preparing arrest warrants and things like that. But obviously, that all begins with the initial contact of either a suspect, a subject, or a person. And for the most part, As a police officer, it all depends how you approach a situation. And unfortunately, sometimes, as in the case with Trooper Vasquez in Chicopee, Massachusetts, his initial approach was rounding the corner only to be shot at. Whereas
mm-hmm.
in some instances, you are dispatched via a radio call, Officer Azelton of the East Hartford Police Department a number of years ago was dispatched to a routine domestic dispute. And unfortunately, that turned deadly quickly.
Yeah.
And things can change, I mean, just on the turn of a dime. I mean, it happens that quickly. So your senses are always heightened, no matter what the call is, no matter what your interaction is. So although you may be friendly upon initial, you know, the initial meet and greet with someone, whether it's on the street, maybe they're doing something you feel, I don't know, you get that gut feeling something isn't right or just something doesn't look right. You can't let your guard down for even a second.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the academy does adequately prepare you for what's out on the street?
The academy that I attended, again, 15 years ago, has radically changed. When I went through it, it was called the MPTC, Municipal Police Training Council. It is now called the Post Police Officer Standards Training. And in my opinion, officers that I know that are coming out of the academy fresh now, I think in the 15 to 18 years difference, I think there's a lot more focus on sensitivity. And although you want to be sensitive and you want to be compassionate to someone's problem, you have to take a step back and you really have to evaluate both sides. If it's a domestic dispute or it's a confrontation or a problem between two people, you can't take sides. It's very difficult, but from the academy training that I had, I felt very prepared to go out. But again, there's no cookie cutter, this is what your job is.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I think I used an analogy years ago that if you are a cook at McDonald's and you're in a trainee stage and you're preparing cheeseburgs, and there's supposed to be 12 that are supposed to come out, and it's supposed to be the lower bun, the burger, the cheese, the pickles, the mayonnaise, and the onions. If you make it upside down and you make a row of a batch of 12 of those, and you make it the wrong way, not by the way corporate has dictated, your manager is going to come back and say, you've done these wrong, make sure you work on it. That's a very, easily fixed problem or mistake, and that you can address it, and that's it. But as a police officer, sometimes you don't have that do-over. You don't have someone
right.
to come and say to you, you did it the wrong way, because you're talking a life or death situation in some instances.
Mm-hmm.
So if, just like Hollywood portrays, unfortunately, there are unfortunately a lot of police officers, I think, that someone quickly reaches for a cellular phone or whatever. If it's dark out, the strobe lights are going on top of your cruiser, it's raining, there are so many different factors. You can make a split-second decision that will
mm-hmm.
affect someone, including yourself, for the rest of your life.
Right. Did you have a partner in your car? Right along. I'm thinking as you were talking, the other show, we grew up with that Adam 12 and those kind of things where, maybe that second cop in the car would be able to give you feedback about, we could have handled that a little differently or whatever. But when I'm driving in traffic, a lot of times when I see a police cruiser, there's just one person in there. Is that the norm?
That is the norm, unless you're riding, unless it's a big city like New York or Boston where you've got partners. Unfortunately, town budgets and city budgets are stretched so thin right now that sometimes protocol now with a lot of police departments, someone could be screaming bloody murder inside a home, and you're the first officer on scene, but policy and procedure in writing from the department clearly states you cannot go in until you have assistance or backup.
Mm-hmm.
And that how frustrating is that for a current law enforcement officer that you're hearing someone, you're hearing something happening, but if you go in and you act, maybe it'll work out. But if it doesn't, you violated departmental policy.
Well, that also makes me think of my good friend Dr. Bill Pettit and that whole protocol that they followed, whether it's right or wrong. Could it have been a different outcome? But I know what you're saying, and that's very important.
And I'll echo your sentiment there. Let's take a second and talk about Columbine.
Okay.
They waited because they weren't quite sure how to address it. They weren't. Something like this had never happened before, but
right.
I hate to say it this way, but it is a heck of a learning experience that now police departments don't wait. They, in an active shooter situation, once there's one, two, or three, they've been trained. Our own Enfield Police Department, I know, has utilized in the summertime both high schools. They've utilized older buildings. Where I went to grade school in Suffield, in small elementary school that's actually been closed down, called Bridge Street School in Suffield. They
mm-hmm.
use that as a training facility regionally. I see the Massachusetts Sheriff's Department there. All kinds of different departments come there for active shooter training in a school. And now just like with Sandy Hook, they went in immediately because they know. They found from Columbine that by waiting, it costs lives.
Mm.
Right. And how often or how is your training? I mean, you get into a situation like this and your instinct kind of kicks in. So if you're pulling back your instinct to go in and do what you're trained to do, how many times do situations like this have a bad outcome instead of a good outcome?
For me personally, off the top of my head, it's been, like I said, a number of years. I, thank God, never had to use my weapon or discharge my weapon. But for other officers, it's a split second decision. And this is one of the areas that definitely as a trainee, recruit, rookie police officer, and initially going through the police academy, these were things I never even comprehended, that you can be in a situation that you have to absolutely make a split second decision that will affect you and can affect dozens of people down the road. Again, with a shooting, with someone with a knife, there's now mental health issues have come to light.
Of course. And how do you prepare for that mentally or even physically? You try to, you know, keep up in terms of being in good shape and all, but how can you possibly prepare for that? You just, like you said, you're on high alert. The stress level must be, you know, just intolerable.
It is. It is. And I know a lot of police officers that I'm friends with that have, thank God, stress outlets. And that whether it's going to the gym, whether it's working out, just golfing, something that just completely puts them at ease or allows them to relieve some stress.
Good outlets versus alcohol consumption and all those other things that people also do in high stress jobs. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
I'm sure that we talked a little bit about when we were first chatting with regard to some other factors that people might not be aware of, such as you mentioned the fact of you know, the overtime, and you might get certain transmitted diseases if people try to bite you, and you know, different things like that. What are those types of things that you might be able to go into that people don't necessarily know about?
Well, you don't necessarily, definitely, I've never seen anything along the lines on cops or any of the
First 48 is one that's fairly realistic. You've seen that show, right?
Yes. I will tell you what I feel is one of the most realistic recent release. They've only run it one season. Is Boston's Finest.
Really?
It's an absolute accurate portrayal. It's real time about what does happen, can happen. There are partners in that series, and this is an actual ride along with the BPD, Boston police officers, and situations that they get into. And Donna, as we discussed, there are certain times where you'll make an arrest and you won't think anything of it, but somebody might either, well, you do actually think of it. Someone's trying to spit on you. Someone does, unfortunately, get a hold of you and bite you, scratch you. You're booking them, you're fingerprinting them, and they say to you, oh, by the way, I have hepatitis C. All of a sudden, your heart starts racing and you think, oh, my God, am I going to be exposing my family, my kids to this?
Mm-hmm.
Just the ramifications of something like that, it sounds so insignificant, but when you go to cuff somebody, again, that's spitting in the face. They don't want to be handcuffed. You're not, unfortunately, as law enforcement, fire personnel, security personnel, anyone in public safety, you're not always, 90% of the time, you're unfortunately going into a bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, law enforcement, if someone has to get arrested, you're taking away their rights. That's one of the things they talked with us about the police academy is, the simplest thing as saying to someone, sir, can you please remove your wedding ring? That is huge to some people. That is representative. I mean, it's bad enough that they're being arrested, whether it's a DUI, an operating under the influence, anything along those lines. But you ask them to take their wedding ring off, and all of a sudden, it really hits home.
You mean in terms of just collecting the personal belongings if they have to be arrested and putting them in a bag or envelope or something?
Shoelaces, wallets, cell phone, watch, jewelry.
Right.
But to a lot of people, that wedding ring is, it can be the catalyst that somebody's in the station and they lose it. They realize, oh my God, I don't want to do this, and they become combative. Then what do you do? So you really,
because they think they're not going to get it back.
It's not that they're not going to get it back, but I mean, someone who's been married for 25, 35, 40
right.
years,
right.
and they're Good getting morning. Arrested. They're getting arrested for drunk driving, and they're thinking, "Oh, I've got to. I'm going to have to do this." It's, all these things are running through their head, and maybe they've sobered up a little, and all of a sudden, again, they never thought for at all that their wedding ring would ever come off. They never take it off.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're being ordered to take that off. That can be huge to a lot of people.
I didn't realize that was part of the protocol. Did you know that, Delilah?
No, I didn't. Well, I knew you had to turn over your personal property if you're arrested, but, I didn't realize that people got that vigilant over it.
Well, see, we haven't been DUIs, thank God. And,
and it doesn't have to be that, perhaps.
It can be something else. Who knows? They could try to use that in some other way to get out. I mean, I don't know.
Well, no, it's just a matter of to punch somebody bare-fisted in a cell block or being held at a detention cell is one thing, but if you've got a big, fat wedding ring on, where do you draw the line? Do you allow somebody to keep a big college class ring or high school class ring? That
can be used as a weapon, it could hurt someone.
Yeah.
You're
so
right,
you're taking
wow.
away someone. You're taking away someone's personal property, and that can be,
right.
again, just that pit gut feeling in their stomach.
Wow. Mm-hmm. What do you, let's talk a little bit about expectations by the public in your experience. Does it mesh, or are they very separate in terms of what you actually can do and are able to do and what the expectation is? Maybe I'm talking about when you go up to the door and they answer the door and they think you're going to be able to do X, Y, Z, and you can only do X.
Well, again, there's so many different areas here, but if someone calls that they need help, they're upstairs and they hear somebody downstairs and you get that whispered 911 call of there's someone in my home, there's someone downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
They're staying on the line with the dispatcher and they're waiting to hear either a siren or to see flashing lights because it's dark outside. And that expectation it's a high expectation and it's get here quickly. I need help.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the other side of the coin where whether it's a noise complaint or it's a husband and wife who are arguing, someone else is called, the wife is called, or the husband is called, or the child has called, and the parents aren't aware that the child called.
Yeah.
Once a uniformed officer shows up, or two, or three, it really, for lack of a better phrase, ups the ante, and people get uncomfortable, people get scared, people get angry.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, you never know what the whole situation is until you can separate both parties, find out what's happening. The expectation of the public is that the police are coming to help, but that's all dependent upon what these people have seen and or what type of prior interaction over the years they've had with law enforcement. Has
mm-hmm.
it been a good outcome? Has it been a bad outcome?
Right.
The basic speeding ticket. Upon the initial approach, when you get pulled over, everyone gets that gut feeling when there's a police officer behind them, whether the red and blue lights are on or not. I get that feeling. Everyone does.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you get pulled over. But if you're nice and are cooperative and understand that the reason you're being pulled over, it's not a random thing. You're being pulled over for something that you did wrong. And you cooperate. police officers aren't out to rob you of a day's pay, or in some instances, depending on how fast you're going, in Connecticut anyways, a week's pay.
Right, a week's pay.
Yeah. But it all depends, I guess, getting back to the initial statement that you made, what's the perception from the public? I guess it's almost like going to a restaurant. If you go there and you enjoy the service and you've had a good experience, then you're more than likely to go back and you're not going to be nervous about going in there. If you haven't done anything wrong, then really you're going to be relaxed and you should be able to discuss calmly what the situation is and what the problem is. But that's not always the case, as we know.
Right. That's for sure. And it certainly does help. And you don't want to be deceitful. You don't want to try to bribe the person or whatever, because the officer, because it only makes matters worse, as we know. So I also wonder, too, with today and with you bringing up Columbine and mass shootings, do you think now, or talking to your friends that have come from the academy in recent days, is there a big emphasis on the homeland security aspect in terms of preparing for, you know, disasters and mass tragedies versus, you know, when you were there?
Oh, I think we're 100 times more prepared now than we were even 5 years ago, 10 years ago. After September 11th, the TSA federal division that covers pre-screeners at airports and security at the airports, that went from, and I can speak from personal experience, grooming myself to get into law enforcement. I never did go to college. I worked for different security companies, different security type work, and groomed myself that way. And mm-hmm. one of the jobs I did when I was a senior in high school was as a pre-board screener at Bradley International Airport.
Oh.
And in the late 80s and early 90s, that position leading up to September 11th had always been a little bit above a minimum wage paid position, just to check people's bags, have them walk through the metal detector, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
After September 11th, look at us now. You can't walk through with your shoes on.
Cool.
Now what was a private subcontracted company doing the job are now federal, I think they are deemed, and their title is federal agent and or federal officer with the Transportation Safety Administration.
Yeah.
So now they've really stepped that up to a position where they're highly trained and they're focused on passengers that are coming through. They're looking for different behaviors, characteristics. And obviously now the focus, or since September 11th, was safety has been focused on screening and looking for problems at airports.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
I've speculated the next unfortunate event I feel is going to be some type of communications breakdown. We have, as a society, have become so dependent upon cellular phones and the wireless ability that if something were to happen to that infrastructure, it would be catastrophic.
Yeah, wow, that's a scary thought, but actually true. It, you know, we depend on, you know, our computers so much for communication as well, and social media, that it's just part and parcel of everyone's routine lives, that if all of that shut down for some reason, it's the same thing, you know. Very interesting.
Way of making a living.
What'd you say?
I said in some cases, it's our way of making a living. If,
yes, ma'am.
If the infrastructure of the internet went down, imagine publicity probably wouldn't exist. So, think about.
Let's not even go there, right, Delilah?
No.
You know,
no.
I know. But seriously, no, it is, and it's something we need to be aware of. You know, I'm sure there are people out there, master planners, that plot things, as we know from talking to Jeff Mudgett a couple weeks ago, that, you know, that the H.H. Holmes spent 2 years plotting and planning, Delilah, right? So whatever it is that you're plotting or planning, it's not something you just dream up for one day. But before we get into the other aspect that we wanted to talk about, and I know, Jeff, Ward, you're very humble about this event where you did a very heroic thing, and I know you want to downplay it. I just wondered whether, Delilah, you had some other questions at this juncture before we get into what actually occurred where you assisted this Massachusetts trooper. Did you have some other questions, Delilah?
Oh, me? Well, I was just thinking back to what we were talking about earlier with the public perception of police officers, and, you know, depending on where you come from and what your environment has been growing up and what you've watched on television is, you know, going to frame that basis of what your perception is, whether it's a perception of fear, whether it's a perception of respect for authority or non-respect for authority. There's so many things that go into making up those factors. And then, you know, when you start getting involved with different jurisdictions across the country, and you find, I want to know what your opinion on this one is, and I see it happen so often, is we have the good old boy network.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to our listeners, what exactly is the good old boy network?
Good question.
Well, that is a very good question, and I will just cut to the chase and say that my training at the academy and my experience is this. The general public's perception of that police officers, quote, end quote, cover up for each other is just not there. And the reason I feel that it's not there is because, again, getting back to what I first started to discuss about the first day at the academy and liability, if I am riding with a partner and or another officer and I were to show up at a situation or a call, and that officer was absolutely out of line or did something that he or she should not have done,
mm-hmm.
there's going to be, and there is a complaint filed, there's going to be an internal investigation. And regardless of the merits of the complaint, 99% of the time, supervisors will investigate that to the extent of whether it's a referral to an internal affairs division or an internal investigating department or a lieutenant or a captain or even a chief. And if I'm at a call with John Smith, and John is out of line or does something that he wasn't supposed to do, looking the other way is not necessarily in my best interest if I'm called in on the carpet and I'm told, listen, Ward, you were there when this happened. You need to tell us exactly what happened, because otherwise your career – charges possibly, your pension, your future with the department is also, you know, on the line here. So you need to tell us exactly what happened. We have 25 corroborating witnesses who looked down from their apartment building and saw what Officer John Smith did. We also have partial audio now. I mean, thank God for technology, because not only does the audio-visual of a police cruiser's dash cam, but the actual audio equipment that almost every police officer carries now, which, by the way, off subject for a second, I recently saw a police officer, and the introduction of the stun gun, of the taser gun, there is just so much equipment that a police officer has to wear now. I mean, I hope they never have to jump into a river because they're going to go right down to the bottom. But one of the most important pieces of equipment that's come out that is so inexpensive and can be utilized is the audio recording device.
Do you wear that on your person?
Yes, officers wear they are as small as a watch. I mean, they're not that big, and they transmit to a recorder in the police cruiser. And traffic stop. In some instances, when the light bar is activated, or the strobe lights are activated, or the front headlight wig bags are activated for a traffic stop, that equipment turns on right away. So, getting back to your, the good old boy network.
Right.
I think that network is slowly dwindling because the younger officers that are coming up are being told, listen, you can get caught up in this just as much as your partner or your fellow officer. And even though it's admirable of you to try and defend your fellow officer, your fellow coworker, and stick up for them, listen, what's right is right and what's wrong is wrong. What happened?
So what about the blue wall? Is that just a misnomer? I mean, there's websites called that. And what about, you know, maybe what Delilah was talking about, too, because she is in the South. And maybe that, I mean, I hate to paint a broad brush the South, but maybe that occurs more there versus where we are, or it's just a stereotype, an incorrect stereotype, or what? Or what do you think?
My opinion is I think Hollywood glamorizes that. I think,
except for Sheriff Joe Aparo in Arizona, right?
Well, he's one guy I wouldn't want to mess with. That's for sure.
Right.
Yeah. I never had to experience anything like that. I mean, if I was ever asked anything, what's the old expression? You never have to remember the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And law enforcement is now, I don't necessarily want to use the word that it's a business, but it's something where what you do today, has ramifications 6 weeks, 6 months, or 6 years down the road as a civil lawsuit. It's very difficult for police officers, and I'm going off on a little tangent here, but it's very difficult for police officers to go from one call to another where maybe at 8 o'clock at night when it's 95 to 100 degrees out, you've just wrestled with somebody, you've maybe gotten punched, pushed, which is part of your job description,
mm-hmm.
and then you're dispatched to another call within 15 or 20 minutes, and you haven't had time to really diffuse.
Right.
Go, 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 go. And let's face it, police officers, just like everyone else, we're human.
Right.
And getting back to, I guess, again, for lack of a better phrase, the cheeseburger analogy, it's one thing to make a mistake with a dozen cheeseburgers that you make. They can be remade. It's not a big deal. But as a police officer, if you respond, and you let your emotion get the better of you, it's very hard to shut that emotion off.
Right. It sounds like the stakes are just so very high for both in doing your duty and to even – so it wouldn't even cross your mind to, you know, try to cover up your partner because in this day and age, there's so many pieces of equipment or people are watching or whatever that you just wouldn't even consider it. Although I think, you know, perhaps maybe in small podunk towns or something, if that were the case where there's just two officers or whatever, and there is corruption that already exists, like maybe it occurs there more, but with what you're talking about in 2013, I'm glad to hear that, you know, there's less of that. I agree with Delilah. I think there's a good old boy network, and particularly in politics, in the legislatures, too, not only in, you know, maybe not so much with the police department, but that's just my opinion, you know?
Right. Most politicians, in my opinion, I think the two of you will agree, I believe that politicians have always started with some type of volunteer work initially, whether it was in middle school, high school, college, afterwards. And there's nothing there's nothing stronger than the heart of a volunteer. And politicians genuinely want to help people, help their community, help the country. And of course, we could go way off right wing on this and really go askew. But politicians, I think, are doing a great job with what they have.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a lot of issues. And I give politicians a lot of credit for getting into that line of work. Because, look, they get kicked and of course, I'm using this figuratively, kicked and punched and pushed and shoved and squawked at by everyone.
Yeah, it is very challenging. Yeah.
Yeah, and just quickly getting back to the quote-unquote good old boy network, it doesn't matter where you are. Nowadays, there are still very modern police departments. All departments are getting these through federal grants to protect their own, which when we say protect our own, because you have suspects that will come or people that will come to the department and say, your officer was rude, your officer was inappropriate, your officer said or did something he or she shouldn't have done during the traffic stop. So that officer is pulled in and his audio equipment, his video equipment is reviewed. And then to that person who's filing the complaint, it's questioned, are you sure you want to go through with this? Because, you know, I am Lieutenant Jones and I am his direct supervisor and I have seen your traffic stop from the initial to the finish. So you'd still like to proceed with your complaint because what you're signing could be considered a false statement because people come in and they lie. They want to weasel out of getting that traffic ticket by making up a story.
So
but thank God with the advent of technology, whether it's a grocery store or a gasoline station or a bank or a school, there's always a camera watching, it seems to be.
Yeah. Well, it's just to be expected these days, you know. So there's both good and bad about that, I suppose. But, you know, before we, you know, the time is just flying by. We got like 12 minutes left or so. And Ward, I want to get to this whole incident that happened that kind of maybe changed some of your perspectives with respect to what all occurred when you were sort of at the right place and the right time. Can you talk about that, please, so that we get an idea of what went on?
Well, and again, as you had said, Donna, I don't like to talk about it too much, and
there
was
a lot. Well, just talk about it briefly.
Sure. There was a lot made of it, and simply put, it was Friday the 13th, April 12th, last year. Yep.
Okay.
And I was getting ready. I'm a full-time oil delivery driver in the winter, and I was getting ready. It was springtime. We were getting ready to finish up with the season anyways, but shots rang out, and I recognized them as gunfire, and when I came out of our little small oil shop, in downtown Chicopee, people just started yelling and screaming that there was some guy with a gun. And Carlos Laguerre was on his front step having had an argument with his landlord, and apparently his girlfriend was there with their child. And Chicopee police locally responded, as well as state police that were in the area heard the radio call, and John Vasquez happened to be the first one who drove around the corner. And again, this is where things happen so quickly. I mean, they fly off right away. It's right there. It happens. And John drove into a hail of bullets and was shot. He had managed to get out of his cruiser and was behind another Ford F-150 pickup truck, which happened to be a police Massachusetts state trooper as well. His name is Keller Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And Keller was comforting him, but I could hear him saying as I ran around the corner, you know, John, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. And when I ran around the corner, I think I startled Trooper Williams, but But I told him, listen, I used to be on the job. What can I do? And John was there, and he was up against the tire of Keller Williams' truck. And that's when Dave Benoit from the Chicopee Police Department pulled up in a cruiser, and Keller Williams and I and Officer Benoit loaded him into the cruiser, and that's when Benoit just took off. I mean, there wasn't any time to wait for an ambulance. He just took off right to the Bay State Medical Center in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Carlos Laguerre continued to fire. He had a couple of semi-automatic pistols, and I believe, if I remember correctly, he did have an AK-47 assault rifle.
Wow.
He did let I believe it was his son, his small child, go. And I'm not 100%
holding them hostage, Ward? Was he holding his the landlord and his wife and the child hostage? Was this a domestic?
Not the landlord, because the landlord was the one, from what I understand of reports, that had initially had the confrontation, and then Laguerre pulled a pistol on his landlord, and the landlord got out of there and called 911. I think Carlos Laguerre let his either girlfriend or wife or the mother of his child go, and then a little while later let the child go. And there has always been a question. I never researched it or talked to anybody specifically about what happened. There was always a question as to whether Charles Laguerre ended his own life, or if he was killed by either the state police returning fire or the local police. That was never determined. But
okay, so he was shot dead either by self-inflicted or by one of the police officers?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I remember the little six-wheeled remote control vehicle like you see in television. Went up to the front step and looked in, because we were, myself and Keller Williams were basically pinned down. There was nowhere we could go. And I remember Keller Williams saying to me, just stay down. And of course, my initial reaction was, don't worry, I'm not going anywhere. I wasn't about to move. But that all ended the best it could, which was John is back on the job. I got a chance to meet him 6 months later. And, you know, he's a great guy. I'm happy he's back on the job and everything's great with him. I guess all in all, the bad guy was the only one who died that day. And I mean, doing what he did, who knows what was going through his mind.
Mm-hmm.
But people nowadays, unfortunately, as all three of us know, and as all your listeners know, and everyone knows, everyone in the world is under a lot of stress and pressure. It's a much different world.
Yeah, that's for sure. And so, as you said, the media picked this up, and, you know, Chicopee is a small town, so this was big doings there, I'm sure. And what happened after that? When the media...
what happened after that particular day, there was some media interviewing and with me and a handful of other people. And honestly, the next morning I woke up that Saturday and I sat up in bed and I was like, my first words out of my mouth were, wow. It was almost like it was a dream, because
yeah.
To have all that happen, and there was still so much media coverage. And then it kind of faded and went away a little bit. And then I was flattered to receive a letter from the mayor of Chicopee asking if I would attend an award ceremony. The city of Chicopee wanted to honor myself and all the other police officers that were there that helped John Vasquez, which I was flattered. And then after that, I received a letter from the colonel of the and superintendent of the Massachusetts State Police, and I most recently was in Boston and received a meritorious service award from the Massachusetts State Police about 2 or 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago now.
Wow.
And again, it was something I'm flattered, but I just, someone needed help, and you just, when something like that happens, you don't really think. You just, someone needs help, so you just go in and you do what you have to do.
Did they ask you if you wanted to come back instead of doing your oil job?
Well, it's again, where we initially started off with the top of the hour, it's not the job that Hollywood glamorizes.
Right.
It's a very, very difficult job. And police officers, firemen, EMS, security, any type of public safety. And now safety officers in schools, everybody who's in that realm, that circle of public safety, they're all, in my opinion, professional people who are under an extreme amount of stress every day. Because even though they may be laughing and joking and there's the camaraderie, in the back of their minds, they always know that at a moment's notice that can change.
Yeah,
and,
I just can't imagine.
The men and women work, they work very hard. They really do. And they a lot of personal sacrifice. You know, Donna, you and I discussed briefly that one of the things that was never even thought of, I didn't even conceive of it, is you're working an 11 to 7 shift, and at 5 a.m. you're exhausted, tired, but you get a radio call that unfortunately you're mandated to stay due to a staffing shortage. So now you have to work another 8 hours, and you're angry, or not angry, but you're tired, you're irritable.
Frustrated.
Yeah. Your plans you were supposed to spend with your family on that day, they're canceled, but you're on duty, so you have to stay.
Yeah. What would be your advice for someone who, hopefully they don't get all their information from TV or movies, that aspires to go to the academy or wants to be a first responder? What would your advice be?
Well, and not necessarily first responder, but just anyone who wants to get into public service. Absolutely. It can be an extremely rewarding, self-achieving profession. And if you can do 20 to 25 years unscathed by any type of problem, any type of issue, any type of shooting, I mean, but will that, are we talking realistic that that's going to happen? Probably not. But for someone to go into law enforcement or public safety, to be a fireman, to work in EMS, to work in security, any type of public safety, again, it comes back to something inside them is a volunteer. Why? Because they want to help people.
They want to help. And it's not a highly paid profession either.
Compared to some people, right? Exactly. Compared to some people that are sitting in an air-conditioned office.
Right.
And that's not to belittle anyone who has a good job nowadays, because good jobs are hard to come by. But when you're out on the front lines, you're going into problems. You're responding to people's problems in a much – it's not like it's a customer – I mean, you are customer service in a roundabout kind of way. But it's one thing to be customer service for, I don't know, a hotel chain or something like that, as opposed to being a police officer.
Right. And the big difference, as you said with your analogies of McDonald's, there's no do-over, you know. So you have to get it right the first time. And, you know, I just have to commend you. If people would like to contact you or just say hi, would you be able to give us your Facebook address if people just want to?
Well, actually, I'm on Facebook, and it's Ward Hamilton in Enfield, Connecticut.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's
don't forget, we will have a detailed blog of this show, because I think you've imparted a lot of good information. I so appreciate it, and I hope that you will please keep in touch with me, because as I say to all my guests, and I say this in all sincerity, and Delilah knows I'm not kidding, that it's not just a one-shot deal. We've started a relationship, a friendship with all of the guests that we have, and we do have some on occasionally a second time, particularly they have other things to offer. So it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. And I want to remind everybody, please go to imaginepublicity.com and DonnaGore.com, and stay tuned for another episode next Saturday of Shattered Life. So good night, Ward. Good night, Delilah. Thank you so much for your help, and we'll be in touch soon, okay?
Thank you for having me on.
All right. Good night.
All right.